2080 Thrillcast Supplemental, Mick McMahon, Part 1. Borak Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to another Thrillcast Supplemental. We've not had one for a little while, but wow, what an interview to return with. Among the elite ranks of Judge Dredd artists, there is a small number of names which will be familiar to us all as the seminal artists on the strip. These include Brian Bolland, Ron Smith, Cam Kennedy, Carlos Esquerra, and of course, Mick McMahon. Mick has done as much, if not more, than any other artist to define Judge Dredd's look and the look of his world, whether it was the way that he rendered Mega City 1 or the big boots style of his Judge uniforms. He's been an artist on some of the most important moments in Judge Dredd's history, and it was an absolute honour to be able to go down to the South Coast to sit with Mick and talk about his life and work. This is the first part of our extensive interview, and hope you enjoy Earthlitz. Let's start at the beginning, because it's the very best place to start. Comics in your youth, what were the kind of things? Was it Beezer and Topper and things like that that you were reading?
Yeah, especially Beezer, because... I don't know, you know, I suppose it's like Marvel and DC, you take one against the other. So I was Beezer, but not Topper. Right. Topper was a sort of an exotic thing that I knew he's had. But those comics were broadsheet size. So when I was about four, my mum, I was going to start school when I was five, obviously, but my mum thought, well, it'd be a good idea if I learned to read before I went to school.
Yeah.
So she thought, well, I can do it. I'll buy him one of these comics. So I've got this thing called the Beezer in front of me, which is as tall as I am, almost. And there's these pictures of hippos eating Japanese soldiers. And she thinks she's getting me ready for a career as, I don't know, lawyer or doctor or something. But I'm thinking, wow, look, someone's doing that. Someone's doing these drawings. Mm. So I started doing drawings. That's how I started off.
That is something that does crop up an awful lot when I'm talking to creators. Is there's a moment when they're young when they realise that actually there is somebody. These things don't pop into existence. There is somebody who's writing them. There's somebody who's drawing them.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned the example of, like, you know, hippos eating people and stuff like that. Was this an early warping of your imagination by comics?
I think so, yes. But it wasn't helped either. Because where I went to school, primary school, was a Catholic primary school run by nuns in St. Albans. Now, of course, St. Albans is Verulamium, Roman Verulamium.
Mm.
And the very first British martyr, St. Alban, had his head chopped off on the site of the present abbey.
Yeah.
So quite often, I would be asked to do a drawing for the school, or a painting, you know, of St. Alban. Well, actually getting his head chopped off. But and also, when it was St. Patrick's Day, I'd have to do a painting of a pony in trap going through and kill, you know, I don't know, the Mount of Mourne or something. So I was sort of helped a lot, actually, in primary school, because I was given special time.
Right.
To do stuff like that, so
yeah, that seems like a very different reaction to a kind of Pat Mills reaction to a Catholic upbringing. Whereas for him, it was very
well. They
human restriction.
No, I think because I went to secondary school where it had priests,
right,
and they are a different kettle of fish. So they kind of turned me off being a Catholic,
right?
Probably. But even there, I was sort of given a bit of leeway.
Yeah?
Yeah, to do some art and things. Because they're always really excited to teach us, to find people who are good at something. So, and they want to sort of help you along, I think.
And was there any indication in your mind that this was something that you could make a career out of?
Well, no, not really. It depends on what age, I suppose, I'm talking about. But, I mean, I would have had an idea I want to be an artist. Because you start thinking you are one, really. Because kids are coming, are you coming out to play football? No, I'm drawing.
Right, right.
You know, it's that kind of thing. So, or you go to the pictures or something, and everybody else come home and start, they want to go out and play,
yeah,
and killing each other with swords and things. I'd stay indoors and draw it. So it just takes over, really.
Yeah. You went to art school after...
I did, yeah. I went to St Albans Art School for... Right. I did an introductory course. They did a special course for people who sort of showed some talent but didn't have an A-level.
Right.
Because I'd failed A-level art at school.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And the person who's... I did... There was another person, one of my mates. I did his lino cut for him, and he passed.
So it was an honorary pass.
Yeah. But anyway, they had a special course to get an A-level. I got that. And then I did the foundation course, and... Then I went to Chelsea School of Art.
Oh, right, okay.
Which was a mistake, really. They did do an illustration course, but they were more Radio Times kind of illustrations.
Right.
You know, they're sort of little woodcutty things. Or
okay.
I mean, they were well done. I mean, they were good. They were good tutors and things, but it wasn't for me, really. So.
Was there... I mean, I've heard different experiences from different artists who've been to art school. Was there a sneering tone towards comics there, or did you try to do comics?
Well, my interview,
there?
The interview, the illustration tutor said that she said, which is, well, I'm a snob, I don't like comics, you know? but it didn't stop me getting in there. So I mean, well, it wasn't that much of a snob. Perhaps she thought she'd sort of save me from myself.
Yeah.
So, but I did enjoy doing the illustrations.
Yeah.
Things, a lot of the time, but I'm. When I was at the foundation course, though, I was actually quite good at painting. I was enjoying that.
Mm.
So I suppose I was thinking about being some sort of painter.
Okay.
But I was really put off. You have to have... It's not good enough to just do a painting now. Mm. You have to have a manifesto or something. You know, that you have to be able to explain why you've done it.
Right.
Well, if I could explain it, I wouldn't need to paint it. Yeah. So.
But the stuff that you learned at art school, did that stand you in good stead for things like when you came to... produce stuff in colour?
No, it didn't. I mean, that's why it was a mistake, because there was a college at Watford, Cassia College. They did a art course, but that was all about learning how to use materials.
Right.
And I was at 3 years at Chelsea School of Art, and I was never once taught how to use anything. It was all, you know, start from scratch with everything.
Right.
So I wasn't that impressed with that, really, because I thought that's what you would learn, you know. But,
yeah.
But you were just left to your own devices, because I think they were more like on the fine art kind of side of it.
Yeah.
But it was worth it doing it, really, though, because it gives you, like, some time to just keep practicing, because I'm sure I couldn't have got any work at 16. You know, so. I suppose I could get a job in a comics company, but
yeah.
There are only two. So.
Well, you came out of art school and went to straight to Battle Picture Weekly to see if they...
Yeah, it was Battle Picture Library.
Library,
yeah. And it was Mr. Bensberg. I can't remember his first name. Was it Ben? I think. Anyway, Mr. Bensberg, but he liked what I'd shown him, but he said he wasn't quite ready, and then he showed me some real artwork, you know, which brought me out in a cold sweat. You know. But they sent me around to Temple Art Agency, who took me on their books. And,
okay.
They got me some work on, because DC Thompson were going to do a science fiction comic when they heard of, obviously, got wind that 2000 AD was going to be started. So I did a couple of things for that I wrote. They were awful. I mean, they really were awful.
Please tell me these things still exist.
Well, not, I haven't got them.
Oh, right, okay.
Mind you, DC Thompson keep everything, don't they? It's probably in their vault.
So. In their vast, vast comic vault, yes. Yeah.
But then I'd started to read... Because Smiths had started selling Warren magazines.
Oh, yeah.
They'd started doing a UK edition. So, and there's all these really great Spanish artists that I'd never seen before. And also Paul Neary was in there, and he was doing this science fiction thing. And I was I was really taken with the way he was doing it. So I thought, I'll have a go at drawing like that. And of course it wasn't anything like that. But I did this thing in pencil about an old knight riding around on his horse.
Yeah.
And... that's what they showed to Pat Mills, and he saw that and said, I could draw George Strait.
Okay.
It was only 6 pages in pencil, but...
But there was still that desire to work in comics. You came out of art school. Oh, yeah.
I remember I went for an interview at a photographic place in Welwyn Garden City. Right. They were looking for someone to do paste-up work.
Yeah.
And I told the woman there, I said, well, you know, I'm not really interested in paste-up work. I want to do a comic. She says, well, you'd be better off trying to do that. She says, you're still young. You know?
Yeah.
I said, you haven't got a mortgage. I said, no. She said, well... Yeah. Don't come and work it. So.
What was it? Comic book artists don't tend to work with agencies these days. What was it like working with agencies? Was it a close relationship, or was it just you were on their books and so?
No, just on their books. I used to see them occasionally. And, yeah. I mean, they were nice, friendly people, and because I mean, Don Lawrence was on their books, and Ramon Sola.
Oh yeah,
was on their books. Yeah. But. After a while, when you start delivering the work yourself, you think, well, why have I got an agent? You know? Yeah. But I did stick with them until I got sick, and then I just stopped.
Right.
Because I wasn't doing any work. So, but when I started up again, I think they'd gone out of business.
Right. So Pat Mills, 2000 AD, Judge Dredd. Now, when I've interviewed you before, you've mentioned how you were separated from the kind of day-to-day machinations of 2000 AD and, mm-hmm. and the office gossip and everything. We sort of blissfully unaware of what was going on with the various kind of scripts being brought forward and then dropped back and...
No, I didn't know anything about that. Right, I was just given a script and I'd draw it.
Right.
Because, I used to think Kelvin Gosnell was the editor because he dressed smart and had a pipe. So. And it was while after I found out what was really going on. But I think because there was at one point the management wanted me off the comic.
Right.
I only found that out much later. But that was when Pat gave me an annual story. He didn't tell me why.
Right.
And then, I think because he'd parked me for a while until the heat.
I mean, was that fairly early on? Was 2008 being published already?
I'm not sure. It must have been out for a while, I think. But that was very early on. I mean, I think it was about the fourth or fifth street. Yeah, it probably was now, actually.
Okay. And of course, the first strip, the first Judge strip to be published was your artwork, but with... A photo stat from Carlos's bank job put on the front page. You had to redo that first page a few times. The view of the Empire State Building.
I'm still not very good at drawing buildings. it was the nightmare. Really, I can't believe they put up with it. Really. It was I think Jan had to sort of retouch so many things.
Oh, Jan Shepherd.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
She was fixing things. I mean, I remember there was one. Judge Giant.
Yeah.
I think the story had his dad in it or something. Pappy, I think it was called.
Yeah.
But she'd, when I got the artwork eventually, years later, she'd gone to town in it, I think, sort of whiting out, fixing Pappy.
What, whiting out his face or...?
Yeah, his face, redrawn his face.
Wow, okay.
Because I think, I suppose they do that anyway, you know, they don't know who you are. It's a good job they did. It was a terrible drawing.
So. But not changing his ethnicity.
Oh, no, nothing like that. No, right, it's just because I was trying to draw an old man.
Right.
And I wasn't doing it very well.
Because you were asked to imitate Carlos's style in those early days. And I remember reading, there was a quote from you where you said you couldn't believe that somebody couldn't tell the difference between your Carlos and Carlos's Carlos.
Yeah, I think that. Because he can draw. Well, that's different. And really, I mean, I was trying to imitate. And the first two, I think I sort of pulled it off. Mm. Sort of. But only in terms of the way he was laying out pages.
Sure. Things.
But the actual drawing, I mean, there's no comparison. Well, he had a lovely fluid, easy style, you know, and I was really forcing it. So.
But how old were you by this point?
22.
Yeah. I mean, asking a 22 relatively untested artist to mimic the style of somebody who's already been working for 20-odd years in the industry. That's quite a tall order. What did you think of that instruction to draw like Carlos?
Well, I was quite happy to do it, really. I thought I can work here in this comic.
Yeah.
So, because I hadn't done anything really for a year after I left art school.
Okay.
So I suppose, I mean, it wasn't like I was desperate, but it was I could see it was a good story and good character. So, and I knew really I wouldn't carry on drawing it like Carlos or trying to draw it like Carlos. So I didn't have any objection to it at all.
Mm. Did you have a sense that 2080 was going to be something special, that it was going to do well? It was just a job that you
Well, it wasn't just a job. I mean, I thought it was going to be a good comic, but I mean, whether it'd be a successful comic, I had no idea. Because, I mean, lots of things I've liked, comics I've liked, that lasted, you know, two issues. What I like and what's successful are two. Don't have much relation to each other, really.
So you did the Judge Whitey story, and you were also responsible for Rico, for the look of Rico,
that's right,
wonderful mishmash of surgery on his face. Can you remember if that was an editorial thing or that was, it just said, make him look ugly?
No, it was like, I think Pat sent a load of notes with that.
All right, okay.
Plenty of reference for that. I mean, it's like whenever Pat would send stuff, he didn't command you to make it look like something definite, like something very particular. But what he wanted was something that had the flavour of what he wanted. And I think that's probably what happened with that.
Mm.
But that was I remember it was, took quite a long time, I think, to figure all that stuff out.
Yeah.
But looking at it now, I mean, it's like it shouldn't take longer than about 20 minutes. really. But it's... Was that with the fourth story? Was that?
No. Rico was prog 30-something,
was it?
I think.
Right. No, I'm getting confused. I tend to think of it in chunks, you know, like the first...
Yeah.
Up to something like, I don't know, Brain Blooms or something, and then it's sort of vague bit, and then Cursed Earth. So.
Well, just picking up on something you said there, you described Pat Mills as the best editor you've ever worked with. Why was that?
Because he was hands-on, really.
Right.
He was enthusiastically... got you to do things rather than waited for you to do something and said, oh, you'd have to change it.
Right.
You know, so you more or less getting it right first time because you wanted him to be happy with it.
Yeah.
You know?
But that's interesting because a lot of the artists that I've talked to have preferred their editors to be very hands off.
Mm.
But I guess his enthusiasm is or was infectious.
Well, there's two ways of looking at it, really. I mean, most editors are hands-off, but for me, that means I start drifting along. You know, it's like, and things don't get done on time.
Yeah.
So, but if you've got an editor who's, when you get a script from them, it's full of notes and stuff, then you feel like it all matters. You know? It's like, it's got to be done.
It's like
working at the cold face. So.
I guess you were pleased at the time with getting so much work because, I mean, certainly that first couple of years of 2080 is full of your stuff because, you know, you've not just got things like The Return of Rico, you've got Robot Wars, you've got Cursed Earth, there's the Judge Child Quest, The Day the Law Died, all of this stuff, your artwork there is ubiquitous in that phase. So I guess you were... just very happy that the work kept flowing.
Yeah, it was great. Well, it was. I mean, you guys get. I mean, if you get a feeling that they like what you're doing, then it makes it much easier, doesn't it? I mean, that's the other thing about hands off as well, because sometimes you don't really know what they think, and you don't like to say, "Is it any good?" Because they're probably going, "Yeah, it's all right." I don't know.
You mentioned about that you knew your style would differentiate from Carlos's over time.
Mm.
How quickly did that process begin? And was it something that naturally happened or something that you purposefully moved?
It just naturally happened because I couldn't, I just forgot to do it. I mean, the only thing, because he had that thing, didn't he, where it looked like it had lumps and an outline.
Yeah, yeah.
And I kept doing that for quite a long time, even when the other stuff didn't look anything like Carlos as well. So, and it I suppose it happened, didn't take that long, I think.
Yeah. It's certainly noticeable. I mean, even to an eye that isn't looking for it, when you get to something like The Day the Law Died, then the sheer difference between the style that Carlos had done, your style, and Brian's as well, was very different. I mean, I was writing a feature about the SJS the other day, and of course hadn't realised that in The Day the Law Died, Brian was doing the SJS uniform as one way, and you developed your own very singular look for them.
Well, that was because there was the coordination was sort of starting to fall apart because I didn't even know you were drawing them. So when I just drew it because they hadn't sent me any reference to what he was doing. So, or maybe we were doing them at the same time. I don't know. So, but that started happening quite a lot.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think it was because Ron was doing stuff as well. So. And I think by that point as well, you got it wasn't just the uniforms looked pretty similar, but everything else, the cities and everything looked completely different. And you thought, well, does it really matter anymore? You know, really. So, because I mean, Ron had his skyscrapers.
Yeah,
and what have you. So.
Well, that leads us nicely on to the development of your big boots style. By the time you've got past the judge, by the time you've got to the Judge Child quest, what most people would identify as the Mick McMahon style is there. You know, the big pads, big boots, a skinny dread, lots of nice shadows and surfaces and lines and everything. Were you happy with that? Was that where you felt you were happy?
Yeah, on the Judge Child quest, I finally thought I was in control of what I was doing.
Right. Okay.
Well, I thought I wasn't really, but I did think I was, and I was really pleased with it. I mean, there was one, the first Angel Gang story, where is that one starts off with a giant gorilla and his sunglasses, like the one before that.
God, it's been that long since I've.
Yeah, but anyway, that one, I was doing, first couple of pages, and I thought this is looking really good. I've never thought of that before about something I was doing. I thought, this is looking really good. Yeah. And I mean, I don't like it now, but at the time, you know, it's really nice. If occasionally you think you work into your full potential, so because I'd sort of got the right balance then between speed and drawing.
Yeah.
Because before that, I think I was working far too quick. And of course, gone the other way now. So.
with the Angel Gang, they've got such a distinctive look, like straight out the gate. There's no kind of vagueness to how they appear. What was your inspiration for them? Was it westerns? Was it anything else? Was it direction from
the script? John wrote it as a western, I think.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like. I mean, he John didn't give you a lot of reference and stuff, but he used to say quite a lot in the script about what these people should look like and or what sort of character they were. So that made it much easier to design them.
With something like Mean Machine, he and the rest of his family were killed off in the Judge Child quest, but then. He's returned again and again and again over the years, and I think that's probably partly to do with just how distinctive and unusual and what an expression of what he is part of his physicality with the dial and the arm and everything. Mm. I I guess you didn't have any inkling that, that this would be anything more than a passing character who...
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I mean, he was just... I mean, at the time when you're doing it, it's the most important character in the world, isn't it? I mean, because otherwise you got to care about
him. Yeah.
Feel for the character, but then when you go on to another character, that one's gone.
Yeah.
It's like, and then the next time you drew him, you think, now, why did I make his head so bloody complicated? You know, so I couldn't keep drawing it. So.
You get characters like Merv the Oppressor, who's got all that fantastic mad hair everywhere. That must have been a nightmare to.
Well, no, because that was at that point I'd got to the. Because I had to draw the living planet with its tendrils.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
And because that's the same story, isn't it? So yeah. I'd drawn the tendrils, and I thought, hey, I'll just do all these lines. It's nice. That, like I said, it's a nice Friday afternoon job. And that was the same with his hair. Because until then, I'd felt that probably it wouldn't have sat right with the way I was doing a lot of black.
Mm.
I think it's hard to explain it, really. But it would have been the wrong... texture.
Okay.
See what I mean? But yeah. I think there comes a point where you get the right balance between shadows and light and that you can start putting in more sort of grey tones. Like the lines would make a tone rather than a shadow or something. I don't know.
I mean, was it a challenge to be working in black and white, or is that your...
No, that's what I draw in. Yeah.
Right.
So, well, really, I just draw in pencil. But the black inking, black and white inking is much more challenging, obviously, because you can't fudge it. Well, yeah. Well, I suppose you can, but not the way I do, because I just do it with a pen. So don't use splodgy bits of jade cloth.
Because your pencils are very clear, they're very strong. It's what you
they
see
are,
in
yeah.
pencil is what you get.
Yeah, it's because I think a lot of my early inking on 2008 is the pencils were very clear, very sharp, and then I had to ink them very fast.
Right.
So a lot of that gets just thrown away, you know. But because you've got a basis there to work from,
yeah,
it does sort of hold together.
And in terms of how you were working at the time, I mean, so many artists now are either wholly or partly digital in what they do. But at the time, was it just your pencil, your pen, your Bristol board, a bit of white out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it might have a bit of sort of electrotone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, electrotone. If in doubt, that's looking a bit bare. You know, let's put some electrotone on there. So. Or the other rub down text, you know, instant text.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He said quickly reading. You mentioned about how you felt that you'd kept up with kind of how a squarer was laying out pages. Some of the page layouts in things like the Judge Child Quest, I mean, you mentioned the Living Planet there. I mean, those double page spreads are absolutely huge, not just in terms of what they portray, but the actual original
physical
artwork.
Size.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of work to pour into a single image. Did you pay any heed, or was this just, I guess you knew no different. This is just what you did, wasn't it?
That's what I did, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everyone did them that size. I mean, that was the size I asked for.
Because
so. I remember once Kev, he'd been doing a bit of mowing in his front garden. He got sunburned really badly.
Right.
And to save a bit of time, he'd drawn one of his pages same size.
Oh, right, okay.
Which was a no-no. Because, yeah. I mean, he wasn't paid the full rate for it.
So, really?
Yeah, so...
Even though he delivered a page of artwork?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was just the size you worked at. Because they are massive, yeah. Because I haven't got any of my own pages from back then, but I've got a couple of Kev's Nemesis pages, and they are huge.
Yeah.
And you wonder, how do they reproduce? And yet they do.
Yeah. We're reprinting the Cursed Earth Uncensored. We're printing the Cursed Earth Uncensored book this year. And we were very fortunate that one of our fans, Mark Perry.
Oh, I know Mark. Yeah. He was around my house in Havers Heath once.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, he lent us the pages of the Burger Wars that you drew. Obviously, those episodes have been effectively banned since they were originally printed. Do you have any memories of Burger Wars? Because McDonald's was only a relatively new thing back then. I think there were only two or three restaurants in the whole of in the UK. Yeah. Were you aware of these big brands that were coming over at the time?
Vaguely, yes. Mm. I mean, I'd actually been to the McDonald's in Piccadilly.
Oh, right, yeah.
First one. Uh-huh. I'd been there. I think the girl I was going out with wanted to go there. We never went there again. But no, I knew who they were. I mean, I'm as full of Americana as everyone else. You know, it's hard not to be. But the stories, I thought, because they were John, weren't they? They were just funny. So, easy to draw. They're really funny because they were they're very American as well. I thought they were sort of a fundamentalist sort of fast food chain.
which is
in fact what they are like really in real life.
Well, yeah, absolutely. They wish to rule us all with the iron fist of burgers.
Because my wife Chris, she used to work with a firm that did a lot of, when McDonald's came here first.
Mm.
Her firm made all the buns for them.
Right.
And she developed the soft drinks and the cola.
Really?
And that. So, but she used to go to the, didn't attend it, but she had to go there to do a presentation to the, I think it's the College of Hamburgerology that they had in London. They had a professor of hamburgerology. So.
Which sounds like something straight out of Cursed Earth.
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
I think that's what, yeah, there was certainly a professor of hamburgerology.
Right. So. What's it like knowing that these, finally, after knocking on for 40 years, these strips are finally going to be reprinted?
Well, I don't know, really. I mean, it's because I never really understood why they were banned in the first place, to be honest.
Lawyers, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I said before, I wasn't really interested in why they were banned. But they're because people can see them, because they are, I think there's a lot of work in some of them spreads as well. They're big crowd scenes.
Yeah, well, having that double page spread, because we're doing a print to go with the special edition from our web shop. And that's a lot of work in that page.
There's another spread as well, isn't there? Isn't it where they're being brought into town?
Yeah.
With Ronald in back of his pickup or something. So, there's a lot of people in that as well. But really, when I was drawing those spreads, all that cursive other stuff, really, I was just drawing some World War II American soldiers, really, with some, might look a bit mutated or something. So. That's how I saw that. I thought it was World War II.
Yeah. Because it does seem like the Cursed Earth is the place where every obsession of British people from the 1970s and early 80s kind of gets distilled down into this. But every assumption about America, every twisted stereotype we get from their media and our media just gets dumped there and dialed up to 11. It's just this... It seems that you were having a lot of fun with your episodes of The Cursed Earth. Mm-hmm. Brian was definitely having a lot of fun with his stuff. And all that seemed to really match Pat and John and Jack Adrian's scripts as well. Was it fun? It seems like an odd question to ask, actually.
Yeah, it was great fun.
Yeah.
I think as well, because it was new to the strip.
Yeah.
I mean, you could do anything you wanted with it, really. Because, I mean, I don't know what happens now because I haven't read it for a while. But, I mean, I think it still is, because it's so big, you can have anything you want there, can't you? Just probably have an oasis of, people being nice to each other.
You got to draw a giant Tyrannosaurus Rex in the middle of a futuristic sci-fi strip.
Did all that. Yeah, that's great. Because that was Pat's famous... panel description was one of the dinosaurs is leering at the reader. Which always goes down. Hey, look at us, look what we're doing. You know? Don't you wish you were doing it?
Moving on from that, we get to something like Blockmania. Now, we'll talk about what happened with that in a second, but dwelling on your style, you did some annual stories around about that time. I think it's the 1982 Judge Dredd annual, where the index page is a picture of Dredd, and he's flanked by loads of judges on the steps of the Grand Hall of Justice.
Oh, I remember that.
And for my money, that's the first time I really got a sense. I mean, I'm reading this years after it happened, but that's the first time I really got a sense of this, of Dredd being a kind of totalitarian nightmare. These faceless judges. Your style seemed to really emphasise that, because all of them look the same. You know, it's an incredible consistency in the uniforms. What were your feelings towards the character by this point? Because, I mean, you did 77 episodes of Judge Dredd between 1977 and 1981. I think I've got that right. So you've been working on for a while. What were your feelings towards him as a character?
Well, when I first started doing it, he was, I thought he was a policeman. You know, he was, and he was, I suppose he was a bit violent, but he wasn't that sort of out of the ordinary, really, I didn't think. I mean, he still had his heroic thing, like the Cursed Earth thing. Yeah. He's been heroic, you know. But as it went on, I didn't think he was heroic anymore.
Yeah.
I just thought he was violent and repressive.
Yeah.
But in a, because it's a fantasy, in an amusing way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that picture you're talking about, I suppose that sums up how I thought he was. That he, no humour, no ego, just, you know, the law.
Yeah.
And that made him much, much easier to draw, actually.
Oh, really?
Because then he becomes this sort of rigid, sort of solid, no-nonsense, nothing flamboyant character. All the other stuff can go crazy, but he will always be just like a core of it all.
Yeah.
Being sort of immovable and...
Well, there's those amazing covers you did. The one of Dredd sort of sat back in a chair, like a giant Dredd in a big chair over the city.
Oh, like the Emperor.
Yes, yeah. And one of my personal favourites, which is him sat on the word crime.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just blown it to be just any questions.
Yeah.
And you're right, there's such a weight to him. Whereas everything else around him, particularly when you start getting towards the kind of Blockmania stuff, the way that you draw feet gives people a surprising amount of buoyancy and lightness. But Dredd is always, boom, 2 feet on the ground, you know, absolutely solid. So I can see exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, because he wasn't a character that would, it wasn't written like that either, who would do athletic things.
Right.
You know, he'd walk about, he'd ride about, and he'd shoot people. You know, and that's basically what he did. I mean, he didn't do any stunts, did he, really? I mean, occasionally he might do something, but most of the time he'd just be following on remorselessly, relentlessly, whoever he was chasing.
Because the stature you gave him changed over time as well, because certainly with something like The Cursed Earth, that wonderful iconic image of him essentially crawling the last few feet towards Mega City 2. He's quite rangy. He's gangly, but then by the time of Blockmania, he's much more solid, much thicker. Mm. That kind of ties in with that whole kind of, you know, the faceless.
Yeah, that's right. Slab of a man. He's got to look solid and. I mean, it was subconscious as well, but. Because I never actually sat down and thought, well, you know, I think it's that. But it's just a response to the development of the character. Because I think I read something the other day, though, about complaining about superhero films.
Yeah.
all they take is their action.
Yeah.
Whereas, just with the point, and same with Dredd, by then I'd been drawing it for a long time, that these characters have got more characterization because they've been around for so long,
yeah,
than anything. Anybody, you know, nothing TV, not in novels, because they keep living and changing and doing things, and you get to know all these things.
Yeah.
So it's just like someone you know, your attitude changes without you even realizing it, I think.
Alongside the way that you draw them as well.
Because that's the response to the way you feel about them.
Yeah. So Blockmania was the straw that broke the camel's back to a certain extent. Tell me a bit about what happened after those first few episodes.
Well, it just took me so long to draw. I mean, right. I thought I'll go broke. Because I got to the point, the way I was drawing was, I had to draw everything.
Yeah.
Because when I was drawing The Cursed Earth, I could do scribbly.
Yeah.
But by now, I'd got to this point, I was absolutely obsessive or something, but I'd doing these crowds and I'm drawing every face. You know? Right. I think, well, this is going to take me. God. So I just said, I think it was Richard Burton. I saw him at Comic Mart.
Yeah.
So Richard said, I'm going to stop drawing the story. I can't do it. It's just going to drive me mad.
What was his reaction?
Oh, I would say, don't do this to me. <You know? laughs> But I didn't. Well, I couldn't carry on drawing that.
Because were you slated to do the whole story?
I don't know.
Right.
I have no idea. I mean, I suppose it would have just carried on like it had. You know, I'd do two or three and then Brian would do some and Ron.
Because those few episodes are remarkable for the sense of space and you using.
Well, I think that was part of the problem.
Yeah. Because
by now, in my head, the mega city was real.
Right.
See, this is what happens. It's real now.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't just make a thing up anymore. Now it's real, and the characters are real. So I think I'm drawing a film, you know, and I'm struggling to make everyone in it a character and stuff like that. And once you get to that point, you can't carry on. You drive yourself around the bend. So, I
think. Because you're
unless you're going to pay you loads of money and give you as long as you like. You know, but like I think that is a problem when things become fixed in your head that they do really exist.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't mean in a kind of mad way, but in terms of when you approach this story, you think, this is what it is all like. So,
because you have. You always had a very distinctive look for your Mega City One, and it was always a very consistent look as well. Those wonderful kind of domed mushroom-like buildings,
like pepper pots.
Yeah. It always struck me as quite similar to Carlos's original vision of the idea. Well, that
all
blooms.
All the time, though. I was always still trying to stay faithful to Carlos's vision because it was his character. So.
Yeah.
I didn't want to just throw all that away. So I was still trying, although by the end they didn't look anything like Carlos, but there was still that same flavour to it. That I didn't want it to look like New York. You know, it had to have some sort of organic feel to it. Although the way I was drawing things at the end, I think, and if I did it again, I'd probably draw them the same, but they're just not tall enough.
Right.
There's no room for... You know, 2 mile high things. And they all look like they're about, I don't know, 60 stories or something. But it did have a consistent look. I quite liked when I was doing it, and I thought, well, yeah, it looks futuristic and it looks reasonable that it might happen.
With this sense of it as a real place and the care that you're taking over it, was the feeling that you'd had previous about actually this looks quite good, had that carried through to this moment, or were you beginning to think, well, actually I need to take this further?
I don't think that had anything to do with it at the time. I did feel like I was still in control of what I was doing, but I'd also done in that same style, because I hadn't done a lot of work in that style. I soon gave it up, but I'd drawn a story for Doctor Who Monthly. I can't remember what it was now, some Chinese bloke on a river. Anyway, there was one about a Mississippi gambler or something.
Yeah.
I don't know how I ended up drawing that. But, But I'd drawn that in exactly the same way. But there was something about it that didn't... It started to repel me.
Right.
Like, you know, not all that happy. Because I could do it.
Mm.
I suppose maybe it was getting too easy.
Right.
It was a style that I sort of mastered. And it was just... I could sense it was going to turn into like a formula.
Yeah.
Or something. Yeah. So, which I don't really like. So. Because I'd already done that a few times before when I was drawing The Day the Lord Died.
Yeah.
That was very formulaic, I thought.
Okay.
Which is why I changed that.
I mean, it's something that we'll come on to when talking about your style, but it does... There's never a sense that you stay still for very long in what you do.
No, there's sort of like... There's three phases, I suppose. The first phase is when I don't know what I'm doing, so I'm struggling to find out how to do it.
Yeah.
And then we get to a point where I think I know what I'm doing, so then I'm quite happy then. And then it starts, like I said, slide into a kind of formulaic, repetitive right. thing, which I don't really enjoy. So then it's, you know... Because I always find it difficult to... Do I start a new character to use the style I was using on the previous character? Because it's like... Like they don't fit together. It's hard to explain it, but it just doesn't feel right. So I've sort of had a few months of self-flagellation trying to figure out what this new one looks like. So
you went from Dread to drawing Robusters. It's a very different kettle of fish.
Yeah.
At the time, and it was you and Kev O'Neill, who was still art editor at the time on 2000 AD.
That's nothing. I never knew he was the art editor.
Oh, really?
No, I thought he was like the... Because he used to have a little desk round the corner.
Yeah.
So I thought he was... I don't know what thought he was, but I never thought he was the art editor.
Yeah, oh, right, okay. But there was a great anecdote that I read, which was you didn't think you moving from something like Dread to Robusters could have been accomplished without something like the Temple Art Agency, because you're went out for a big meal with editorial.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's my first experience of a lunch, a business lunch. And it was just a should talk about anything other than what we were supposed to be there for. And they said, how did you feel about drawing Robusters? And I said, yeah, I'll do that. And that was it. That was a business bit finished.
Right, so, okay.
The only thing I really remember about that, I mean, I was told off by the waiter for eating spaghetti with a knife. So.
While we're on the subject of kind of publishing shindigs, when we were just in the pub, you mentioned...
My first Christmas party.
Your first Christmas party.
Faux pas. Or faux pas. No, it was bring a bottle, and I brought a bottle of vodka. And I was talking to, and I still can't remember who I was talking to. I'll find out later. And he was an artist whose work I'd always really liked, and I was really nervous talking to him. So I kept topping up with plastic cups of vodka, and then end up, I'd had so much drink, I just fell over. And I sort of got up and started berating the hat stand, and had to be laid out on the mat, on Jack LeGrand's desk, the managing editor, and came around a few hours later and went, joined everyone in the pub for more beer. So. And when I got home, I was mortified. I thought, that's it. You know, I'm out. My career is over. It's official.
Yeah, you didn't really know how publishing worked.
No, I didn't know actually. Really. So, so that no one said anything. So it must have been all right.
It's not cropped up in the memoirs yet.
Because that was actually in the office, that party. And I don't think they ever had one in the office after that.
Right.
So I don't know if that had anything to do with it. Because I suppose it could have been more mess.
So let's talk a bit about Robusters. Like I said, it was a different kettle of fish. It was Pat Mills. Amazing, wonderful robot mayhem. Mm.
Yeah.
What was it like shifting from drawing all humans to
it was a nightmare.
Really?
A nightmare, because I'd always struggled with the robots in Dread. So why I'd wanted to draw robots is I have no idea. Anyway, yeah. And of course, Kevin was drawing such great, his robots were so great.
Mm.
And I thought, well, I can't just have robots that aren't as great as Kev's. So, but they never did look as good as his, but it was just hard, really hard to get the robots at first. I think by the end, I was sort of got the hang of it. But by then, I developed a style that suited it much better as well. Yeah. So, but I was enjoying it at the end, but not at the beginning.
How did your style evolve to suit the new conditions of this strip?
Well, Kevin had this thing where he'd draw sort of widgety things with, I don't know if you mean, like a machine gun barrel kind of.
Yeah.
Sort of them holes, and he'd be doing his little square dashes. And,
yeah.
And, but once you start doing that, you can't then do flowy, splashy stuff around it, you know. So that then, yeah. Once you started doing those careful kind of machine things, everything else had to fit in with that.
Right.
So that's why I started drawing everything much more carefully.
Mm.
Although I was still doing it quite quickly, because I actually remember I drew 2 pages in the office one afternoon because it was so late.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was penciling them, and I think that, I can't remember who it was, one of the letterers had had to come in, and he was lettering it. And after he lettered it, I'd ink it. And no, I did got 2 pages out that way. And because then you think, wow, I've done 2 pages in an afternoon. That means I can do 4 pages a day. That's 20 pages a week. I'm going to be so rich, I'm going to do all this money. You know? But of course, the next day, you're back to your half page.
Yeah.
There was a few times I had to go into the office to finish things off.
Was that because you hadn't left yourself enough time, or was that?
Yeah. It's usually, yeah. I mean, but with something like Robusters, it used to take Kevin a long time as well. Mm. There's a lot of work if you've got to draw robots, because they've got, you know, widgety bits and you've got to learn how to articulate them as well. Because I mean, there was that robot Dr. Feely Good.
Oh yeah,
with his great big arms and things, and you think, well, what does he look like from the side? First time you draw it from the side, you think, well, you could spend half a day trying to figure it out, because you've got to make it look right.
Yeah,
you know, I don't mean right in the way that if it was a real thing, it has to look like that, but it's got to look like it works.
Yeah,
even if it is nothing like what it really looks like, if you turn around sideways, but it's got to look like something that is pleasing to the eye, almost, you know, rather than, because there's some characters I've drawn that, from certain angles, they're just awful. So you don't draw them from those angles. Yeah. So.
One thing I'm always curious about, the colours on the centre spreads were always bold and vivid and eye-catching. Was that did you do the colour separations for that, or was that somebody in the office who did the colours?
Tom Frame did that.
All right.
Tom Frame, yeah. The ABC Warriors spreads were full colour, so I did those, but... Every other spread, I think, more or less, was coloured by Tom.
Right.
Judge Dredd as well.
Because
once he berated me. He said, you know that spread you just did? I said, yeah. He says, I was colouring that. He says, I thought I'd do it with the sun, like, on the top. And he says, because that's how it looked like you'd done the shadows. And I said, yeah. He says, but of course you hadn't, had you? And I've been all over the place. So, which was true. You know, I just put shadow where I felt like it.
Yeah.
Because in the end, I've given up. I don't really do shadows now. So. Well, I do them on figures and buildings, but I never do them on the floor.
Right.
So I don't know why. So.
Well, that was one of the really nice panels in Blockmania, was where you've got the big crowd running towards the H wagon, Manta tank, or whatever it is, in the centre. Yes. And what little shadow is there is so small and tight, it nonetheless gives an incredible sense of lightness and contrast. And aside from the crowd and the vehicle, everything else is white. But because of that shadow, you don't need to colour in the floor. You don't need to have anything sort of like litter running around or anything, because your eye tells you there's a big floor there.
Yeah, I think what I always do, I still do it as well, is I see when I'm designing a panel. To me, it's just shapes.
Mm.
And if you're going to introduce shadows, your shapes are gone. Bits of, you know, that.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to use it dramatically, you know, like if it was shadow of feet going to the side or something. But so I never draw shadows on anything, under anything.
Yeah.
I might do them under a vehicle.
Yeah.
Perhaps, but not. Well,
this is kind of as an aside, because this is later, but something like Batman, when you worked on Legends of the Dark Knight, shadows are kind of that strict raison d'etre, really, aren't they?
Yes, it's a. Well, I learned my lesson on that one, didn't I? Because the only reason I did that was I wanted to make some money. And I just managed to catch hold of the bandwagon as it was going off the cliff. lots of people had done one. They thought, "Oh, you're going to get so much money."
Yeah,
I didn't.
So. well, we'll come on to the American stuff in a bit. Shannon, about this time, you were doing some Doctor Who magazine stuff because you'd met Dave Gibbons. By this point, it was another.
I'd known Dave before I worked in 2008.
Oh, did you? All right, okay.
Because there was in the local Hearts Advertiser, there'd been a photograph of Dave in the paper because I lived in a village called Coney Heath, mm-hmm. and he lived in a village called London Coney,
right,
which weren't that far apart. And anyway, he'd done a comic strip for Jethro Tull's album cover. Wow. I can't remember. Was it Thick as a Brick or something? I don't know which one it was. Anyway. But there was this photograph of Dave in the local paper talking about working with Jethro Tull. Yeah. And of course, being Dave, he said, "Well, yes," he says, "it's a nice job." He says, "but I'm a soul boy, so you know, I don't really listen to that stuff." So I'd written him a letter.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I said, "Dear Mr. Gibbons, I want to be a comic artist too." So anyway, he'd invited me around his house. I brought my stuff around, and we got on all right, you know. Yeah. And so then I'd got that job, John Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
And I was on my way to deliver the first one, I think. I think it was the first one.
Yeah.
And I met him on St. Albans Station.
Yeah, he mentioned
he was
this.
Going for, I think he was going up there to see them as well or something. Yeah. Or no, he hadn't actually started on them yet because he had an agent as well, the same as Brian's. And he said, "Have you heard about this new science fiction comic?" And I said, "Yes, I'm working on it." You know, Mr. Big, you know. "Oh, yeah, I'm all about that." You know. And but no, so that was a real coincidence as well.
Right.
So of course, then he started working on it, and we used to go, we'll go out for a drink every couple of weeks or something up in London. So.
You eventually shared a studio there, didn't you?
I did, yeah. That was in St. Albans. That was in a workshop behind an antiques shop where... I don't know what the other fellas in there were doing. They were sort of banging and crashing. And I'm not sure they were just fixing antiques, you know, or perhaps they were fixing them. I don't know. So. But that was it was nice working there. The first night we were there, actually, the woman who ran the shop forgot we were there. We were there, locked up. And it was pitch black and we had to climb over the wall. So. It's right by St. Albans Abbey.
Right.
So. But well, someone saw us coming and thought, "Oh, it's people been nicking stuff in the antique shop."
So we were talking to Dave, and there was he mentioned how you used to lean over each other's shoulders and try and pull each other off. So there was there's the famous panel.
Well, he used to watch the fish.
The fish, yeah. The
fish panel, yeah.
from The Day the Lord Died, where Cal's holding Judge Fish over his head.
I said I was working too fast in that, and I was just whoosh. You know,
yeah.
Even the worst panel ever. It really was shocking. He's held it over me ever since. Certainly can't get too big for your boots. You know,
no, absolutely.
If you've done that.
Absolutely.
But I was you know, I was big enough to post it on my blog. Mm. Here it is, you know, the worst drawing I've ever done.
But you were doing stuff for Doctor Who Monthly in the early 80s.
Yeah. A few bits and pieces.
Yeah, but I guess that's a challenge when you're having to render... a likeness. It's not like with Dredd where it's your own interpretation.
Well, I had the man there in the studio with me to give me the best advice.
Oh, okay.
He says, "Mickey, you can't get it right. You only get it wrong."
Right.
He says, "If it looks like him, no one will notice." He says, "So that's it." So I thought, well, I might as well. It's not going to look like him anyway, so I'm not worried about it. So.
I remember very vividly one of the stories you did about, it was Tom Baker. and he's in a scrapyard and he sees a deactivated
sign. Yeah, that's the only one I did. Oh, right. I only did the one. Yeah. Right. Yeah, Dave was on holiday, so.
Right.
So, I took up his slack.
I mean, what did you learn anything from working with Dave about page layout or style or anything like that? Did he rub off on you or did you rub off on him? Or
I don't think so, no, because we're two completely different sort of people in the way we do things. Because Dave's very confident, so he can do sort of a bubbly drawing, you know, like what I mean, like ovals and things, yeah. and then somehow he inks it and it looks great, you know. But if I did that, I'd just become a cropper, you know. I have to pencil it really carefully.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I did learn from him as much as I thought. Oh, that's what a proper artist works like. Because he is. He's a consummate professional, which I'm not. So okay. Far from it. So at least I knew what I was doing wrong, I think.
Well, I mean, you say that you're not a consummate professional, but by this point you've been working in comics for a few years, and had developed your own style, developed your own following as well. Have you always got this sense of never getting beyond a certain point that you're, in your eyes, you're always an amateur and everyone else is a professional?
Yeah. I suppose it's that thing. I feel like I'm an imposter.
Right. Okay. Oh, right. Imposter syndrome, kind of thing.
Yeah. That. Yes, I've done this stuff, but it's not really good, is it? You know, it's like that. It's like I'm not proper.
Right.
Whereas, you know, other people are. Not everyone. I mean, but you know, certainly Dave and Brian, they're, you know, proper artists. And Kevin. And
I know several thousand people who probably disagree with you on that one. But now, I mean, that's interesting that, you know, you went straight from art college to doing 2008. You've made such an imprint on Judge Dredd, on Robusters, on Slayin, and yet in your own eyes, you don't necessarily see the impact that this has had. I mean, do you see the? Do you understand?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, like I said, when I worked in game studios, they're full of people who just poured over my work when they were kids, and that's why they're doing this job, you know, all the rest of it. But what's going on in my head is completely different, because at the time it's a struggle most of the time.
Yeah.
So to me, if I've had to struggle, how can it be any good?
Right. I see. So if it were easier, then that would mean you're good at it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, because I was looking at some things. Some character sketches I've done for a film. I was looking at them today because I was trying to make up a new image to go on my my Windows startup screen.
And such things are life made of.
Yeah. And I was looking at this stuff and I was thinking, I could really draw then. Well, honestly, that's how I felt. I was looking at it, I think, God, that's really good, that. You know, I couldn't do that now. And, well, maybe I could, I don't know. But, I mean, looking at it, it looks far better than what I think I could do now.
It's an interesting kind of psychological contrast, because earlier on you said about how, you know, you have the three stages of things and that your work is constantly evolving. Because you reach that stage where you're not happy with it anymore. But that seems to be fed out of a constant feeling that you're not doing it properly.
Yes. Because it's like, well, now I'm starting something new. This time I'm going to get it right. And it for a little while it might feel like that. But then after a while it's not. It's hard to explain. It is what goes on in my head, though. I sit and look at things. And I think, oh, Christ, you know, what are you doing? What are you doing? You know, stop. You know.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast Supplemental. Many thanks to Mick for being so generous with his time. We have another full episode to go. More from Mick about his days working for 2000 AD and beyond. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do go to iTunes and leave us a rating and a comment. Please spread the word on your social media and to your friends. Thank you so much for all the feedback we've been getting about the Thrillcast. It's really lovely when we hear that it's led to some people rekindling their love with 2000 AD and taking up a subscription again. So welcome to all those readers who've been reintroduced to 2000 AD through the Thrillcast. It's great to have you back on board. See you in 2 weeks' time for more from the Thrillcast and from Mick Bookman. Splendid Verthrig, Earthlitz. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter where we are at 2000AD. Splundig Verthrig, Earthlitz.